Good morning. Wednesday morning Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're going to finish chapter 17 today. And actually, we'll start the first couple verses of chapter 18 as well, just because 18 is a long chapter, and so I want to make it a more even split when we get there. So mostly we're going to be talking about the end of chapter 17. Now, you remember that all of these chapters, 14 through 17, Jesus is talking to his disciples on Maundy Thursday, and this is the last of those. And chapter 17 is titled by most translators as a little title, chapter title, the High Priestly Prayer. You know what a priest is? In the Old Testament, priests, or in other religions, pagan religions that have priests, or as the Catholic Church calls their clergy today, priests, there's a reason. A priest is somebody who is a go-between, who offers up to God, or the God, whatever their God is, if it's false religion. A priest is one who offers up. Well, what is Jesus doing here? He's praying for his disciples, and by extension us, and then praying directly for us. So last week, the first half of this chapter, Jesus was praying for his disciples, his apostles, the 12 or 11 that were there. And one of the things he does a couple times, it'll come up again in the rest of this prayer that we study today, is what is called the prophetic future. Remember that? We talked about it. He's speaking as though it's already happened. He's speaking as though he's already in heaven. Okay, so a prophetic future. He's going to do that some more today in the prayer that he has today. Also, when he's praying for his apostles, and by extension us, we're also in view there, he's praying that we not be taken out of the world, but that we be kept from the evil one. Where is it? Right there. Verse 15. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, that you keep them from the evil one. God has something for you to do in this world. All of you. All of us. Until the day he calls you home, he has tasks for you to do. So he's not asking that you be removed from those tasks, rather that you just be protected from, who's the evil one? From Satan. And what's the worst thing Satan can do? And that is to draw you out of faith, to diminish your faith ruin your faith, I guess. So he's asking that we be protected from Satan, but we still are in this world. We are in this world, but not of this world. Remember, we mentioned that too. And then the last thing I just want to say before we move on, in verse 17, Jesus says, sanctify them in truth. Make them holy through the truth. There is a truth. There is such a thing as truth, contrary to what some philosophers and the world would say. There is a truth. And where can you find that truth, the ultimate truth, the only true truth? God's word. Right there. Your word is truth. Right there. There's an emphasis on that. So, and we know that too as Lutherans. I hope other Christians know that as well. I think some of them do. That, yes, the Bible, God's word, is foremost in knowing about him, in learning about him, in growing in faith, in understanding his teachings, etc. The Bible is foremost. Absolutely. God's word. All right. Questions or comments from about that or from last week? Yeah, Anne?
So you touched on that Jesus was a priest for us.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between a priest and a pastor?
Well, you probably know the answer. You just asked me, so I answer.
I want to be sure.
Okay. All right. Yes, a priest offers up sacrifices or offerings to God or to the God if it's a pagan religion. What is a pastor? Well, a pastor, the word pastor actually means shepherd. That's what it means. It comes from the related Greek word that means pasture or pastor, shepherd. And most of us, at least in the Lutheran church, we would call ourselves not the shepherd, but the under-shepherd, right? We are little shepherds that work for the big shepherd. Who's the big shepherd? Who's
Jesus.
The big guy? Yeah, exactly, Jesus. He's the shepherd. He's the good shepherd. So what is the job of a shepherd? To care for the sheep. So see, there's a different focus. A priest is focusing on serving God on behalf of people. A pastor is focused on serving people on behalf of God. See a difference?
Yeah, that's a great
huge difference. Yes, huge difference.
I kind of remember that.
So we call our clergy pastors, as do most Protestants. Although Catholics do refer to their clergy as pastors, but they formally call them priests. So there is a little difference. Okay?
And the Episcopal Church, it's still priests.
Is it? In the Episcopal Church too? Yeah.
Oh yeah, the Episcopal Church.
Probably the
and probably the Eastern Orthodox churches too.
I don't know what the Eastern Orthodox calls their clergy. But I can tell you, like a priest, who does a priest technically work for? Works for the people. Giving to God, offering offerings and sacrifices to God. Who do I work for? I work for God. I report to Him. If I teach you wrongly, He's the one that is mad with me. Okay? So I work for Him on your behalf. So yeah, it's an entirely different focus, view of the clergy. You knew most of that, Ann.
Well, I do know.
Okay, now you do know.
You want to make sure we all know.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, good question. Any other questions? Yeah, Ellen?
So, Lutherans and Catholics must be not the only ones who wear a collar, right?
No. Episcopalians do. Eastern Orthodox do. I see other, you know, you might see a Baptist. They call themselves the bishop of their Baptist church, and they put on a collar, and maybe they're not as regular about wearing a collar as we are, but I see other churches wearing, the pastors wear. Pardon? Oh, yeah. I think every Lutheran pastor has been called father. Yeah.
What's the definition of reverend?
I don't know. Reverend. Where does that title come from? I don't know. I have to look that up. I usually go by pastor. I rarely have somebody in our church call me reverend.
Is that a revered person?
Maybe.
Means
good. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
So, going along with the pastor for the priest and the father, I interviewed at an Episcopal church once. They were looking for an organist, and they had a woman priest. And she said, "You can call me mother." I said, "Nope. I am not even going to consider a position here because I was just, I am not calling you mother for anything." So,
yeah, that would be kind of strange.
Yeah, well, it is.
Mark?
I didn't even
talk. I was raised Catholic, and I can remember some stuff in preparing for communion to be taught as a youngster.
Right.
About one of the things was saying, don't put the host in your pocket. You were a bunch of 7-year-olds or 8-year-olds.
Right.
And don't put the host in your pocket because it'll turn to blood.
Oh.
Oh, my goodness.
But what I'm wondering is, so is tying that to saying priests, is that, or Catholics saying every service they are offering up Christ?
Yes. They view the Lord's Supper as offering up a sacrifice to God. So it's a re-offering of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, a connection to that sacrifice from Jesus to God. That's how they view the Lord's Supper. We view the Lord's Supper as Jesus giving us connection to Himself, Jesus connecting us to Him, and through that process giving us forgiveness of sins. So while we would agree with Catholics on the real presence, Jesus' body and blood is truly there, hidden within, so Catholics and Lutherans are very close on that belief, we view it entirely different for a different purpose. So for Catholics, yes, it's the priest is offering up a new version, a new element of Jesus' sacrifice to God, and we see it as coming down from God to us. Yeah.
Well, the Episcopalians do something similar.
Yeah.
Because they had, I remember, you know, when I first did their bulletins and so on, they always had oblation bearers, and you list the names of the people. And I'm just, well, what is that? Well, they're the people who bring the bread and the wine up to the altar from the back of the church.
Sure.
So it's like, yeah.
Well, it fits in with the idea that they're bringing forth Jesus as a sacrifice for their sins. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it fits with that idea, which we would say that's not what Jesus said, but, you know, yeah, that's their view, right? Okay. Yes, Andy.
Did you hear the story about, because Catholics give that to children?
Yeah. Usually around like second or third grade.
They had a story going around about this little girl that was crying, and the pastor or the priest come and ask what was wrong, and she said, I got swallowed Jesus, but I can't get him down.
Well,
she was crying because it was stuck.
Stuck in her throat, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, Becky.
This is along the lines, a funny story along the lines, what Sandy said. When our grandson was about, we had communion, we had him with us, and he was so excited to go forward with us for communion, and we found out about partway up, when we were walking up, that he thought it was a picnic, and people were going to be eating up there. So
Yeah, children have some interesting thoughts and ideas, don't they? All right. All right. Let's move on in this chapter. So chapter 17, verse 20. Jesus says this, I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. Well, this is wonderful right here, and I just think this is so profound. This is Jesus very obviously saying he's praying for you. All those who will believe in me. So all future believers are covered by this prayer very specifically. And how is it that we believe? Through their word. Who's the there? It's the apostles who he just previously prayed for. Their word. So this is a little hint to the apostles. Write stuff down, which they mostly did. And so we have the Gospels in the New Testament today. And so through their word, which is documenting what Jesus said and taught and did, then we believe in Jesus. So our faith comes from the apostles' word. And what is the goal of this? What is the goal of our faith in Jesus and the goal of learning and reading what the apostles have written down for us? That they may all be one. Just as you, Father, are in me and I am you in you, that they also may be in us. Does Jesus want us to be united?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Do you think God is disappointed that we have all these denominations?
Yes.
Yes. Unfortunately, we are sinful and we are human and we argue about details. And so these denominations have all split apart. Okay, that's all what it is. I don't think that's pleasing to God, but it's a reality. And, you know, in a certain sense, you know, it was bound to happen because different people will become hard-headed, including us, including me, and we don't want to bend our what we think is the truth, right? So then we have all these disagreements and debates and arguments about what this means in the Bible or what that means in the Bible. Now, what does that mean? Are we still united as one, as Christians?
Yes.
Yeah. Do any of you remember me talking about, it seems like I did it recently, it might have been on the Sunday Bible study, or it might have been a Bible study or two ago, about the essential things you need to believe in order to be a Christian? I see a few heads nodding, but I see some blank stares. You want a quick reminder?
Sure.
Here's a field trip for you. We teach this, Francis Pieper in the Dogmatics textbook that is used in the seminary. It's still our textbook that we, a Dogmatics textbook we use. He teaches this. There are primary fundamental doctrines and secondary fundamental doctrines. That's what he calls it. Primary fundamental doctrines. If you want to be a Christian, you at least need to believe these things. Jesus, that God is triune. One God, three persons. That Jesus is both man and God. Not simply man, not simply God. He was born and became both, united both natures together. We are sinful, and we cannot save ourselves. We cannot do enough to prevent our sin or to overcome our own sinfulness. Jesus died and rose again in the flesh, in the body, not just figuratively or spiritually, but he actually died and rose again. And that it is through faith in him that his forgiveness is given to you. Okay? If you believe that, we would claim in our church body that you are a Christian, and united as the whole greater Christianity, We are united as greater Christianity, and you'll be in heaven. However, there's secondary fundamental doctrines, like what do you believe about baptism? What do you believe about end times, about Judgment Day? What do you believe about the Lord's Supper? Can you believe wrongly on those matters and still go to heaven? Yes, you can. Okay, so that's good news for all of our relatives who have, or friends, who maybe grew up in a Lutheran church and now aren't Lutheran, but go to another church, or maybe for those people in other denominations. They'll still be in heaven, even though, despite the fact that they are taught or believe wrongly on these other matters. Okay? Now, it's still important, so that means it doesn't matter what church you go to, right? No, absolutely not. Because those secondary matters can diminish or weaken your faith in those primary matters. For instance, I'll get to you, Barb, just a minute. For instance, if you believe wrongly about Judgment Day, or if you believe wrongly about baptism, you might wrongly think baptism is man's work, it's something I do to create faith in yourself. Well, then that's going to diminish your belief in point number 5 above, that it is strictly through faith you are saved, not of works. So if you believe wrongly about these matters, it will weaken you in faith in these matters, the primary matters. So it is important to understand everything correctly. However, many churches don't, sadly. Okay? All right, Barb.
You just answered it.
Okay.
I don't remember what number 5 was.
Oh, okay. Yeah, number 5 is, it's through faith you are saved, not of works. Right? Okay, that was a quick recap. I've taught that before in previous Bible studies. Did I say that on the Sunday recently? It seems like I just brought that up recently.
Yeah, you brought that up last Sunday.
Was it last Sunday?
Sunday.
Okay, well, there you go. See, my memory is so bad, I can't remember from Sunday to Wednesday. Mary.
One thing that most churches used to be united on, but no longer are, is, you know, moral teaching.
Yes, right.
There
right.
was a time when all churches, or nearly all, in spite of their theological differences, you know, they spoke with one voice on moral issues.
Yes, very true.
And
no longer.
That is no longer true.
Yeah.
And that is what eventually, you know, started to bother me working for the Episcopalians, because, you know, I knew there'd be theological differences, and that didn't affect me anyway. Well, none of it really affected me, because all I did was the office work, but still, you know, when you find out that they're...
Sure.
You know, going the wrong way on some of those things.
Yeah, no, the division between denominations is getting worse, and I think some of the denominations are actually falling off outside of Christianity, because those five fundamental beliefs, they're failing to teach and believe though one or more of those five fundamental teachings, okay?
So, Pastor, so if it weren't for Luther, would we all be Catholic?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, we probably would be.
So there would be one religion then?
Well, before Catholics, what was the big split before that? Between the Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox, and the Roman Catholic Church. That was the first big split. And that took place in, 700-something? So, yes, there have been splits. And it wasn't just the Lutherans splitting off from the Catholic Church. And, you know, Luther didn't want to split off. He was trying to reform the Catholic Church, trying to correct some of their teachings that had gone astray. And so trying to fix them. And they kicked him out. The Pope, I would say the Pope at the time, was corrupt. He kicked out Luther, and hence began more denomination splitting. Yes,
there were other splits, for example, in England with Henry VIII.
Yeah, all right, the Anglican Church off the Roman Catholic Church.
Split off. Plus, there were other reformers besides Luther.
There were,
I mean, there were Zwingli and Calvin. Very influential also.
Yeah, they also split off.
And some of these other denominations, you know, really have that as their background rather than Luther.
Right.
And there were other people before Luther that spoke out against the authority of the Pope. I mean, there was John Huss, of course, and there were people in England.
Well, have you just read a book on church history?
Well, I'll tell you what, the last couple of weeks, in the Thursday class, Pastor Q has been talking about the Reformation.
Okay, good.
And he gave us a copy of the Reformation timeline and of the different things that happened, you know.
Right.
So it has refreshed my...
Good.
I guess I'm... but I just think that the nominations are something we're stuck with.
Unfortunately.
In this sinful world.
I agree. In this sinful world, we're stuck with them, yeah.
That's
yeah.
why we look forward to heaven when this
we will be united as one, not just in belief, but in reality.
And reality.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Sharon?
I remember growing up, there was always the different denominations, the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Catholics. When did non-denominational church start in?
Yeah, I don't know. I would say, I'm not sure, I'd have to look into it a little bit, but I would say sometime in the 70s or 80s. And it started with them saying, well, we're not associating with any of these denominations. And there were enough of them that said that, frankly, they became their own denomination. The non-denominational denomination. Right. And I've used that comment before. If somebody says to me, well, I don't believe in, you know, some hierarchy of church. I belong to a non-denominational church. And I say, so that's your denomination. Which is true. Because they kind of have a similar belief. All those non-denominational churches have a similar belief. Okay. So, what is the purpose of all this? So, Jesus is praying that we would be one. Just as God the Father and God the Son are one. Why? So that the world may believe that you have sent me. So that the world may believe that you have sent me. There is a witness, a testimony, an evangelism outlook on that, right? When we are united as one, that says something to the world. And yes, Mary, I think you're right. As the moral voice of all the churches started splitting apart, we become less of a moral voice in society, and that has diminished the church's influence in the world. Absolutely. But when we are united as one, that speaks to the world about the testimony of God right here. That's what Jesus is praying for. So here's the second field trip. I don't know if it'll be the last for today or not. Back to back with the first one. When I read that, so that we are one so that the world may believe that you have sent me, what pops into my mind is, and they'll know we are Christians by our love, by our love. Yes, they'll know we are Christians by our love. You guys remember that? I don't know if that was a campfire song or a Sunday school ditty or whatever. I learned that, I know, back in time.
Youth group,
yeah, whatever. And I remember hearing in my church history class, and this is true, reading in the textbook, that in the first few centuries of the church was heavily persecuted. Christians were captured, they were crucified, they were slaughtered, they were fed to the lions, they were thrown into the ring with the gladiators for sport, and yet the church grew. Why? A major factor that the church grew at that point, not only because they were teaching and preaching the truth, but because they were living the truth. In that culture, Roman culture and Greek culture before it, if you were a person that didn't have any capabilities, you were considered useless to society, and you were discarded. So, if you were handicapped, if you were sick, if you were elderly, if you were an unwanted child, baby, they would just put you out and let you freeze to death or die. You're not useful to society. Christians didn't have that attitude. It was countercultural in the first and second century. Christians would care for the sick. They would care for the elderly. They would care for the poor. Again, if you were poor, well, that means you're out of God's favor, so we don't want you in society. Leave us alone. Go out there and just find a corner in the forest and die. You know, that was the attitude. They were not valued at all. Babies were valued. You know, Christians tended to all of these people that maybe didn't have a productive place in society. And it was known that, by the way, if you were a Christian, you had a much higher survival rate of sicknesses and illnesses, because those around you would help care for you. And people saw this. Look at those Christians, how they love one another. They'll know we're Christians by our love. Look at that, how they care for each other. They care about even the poorest and the lowliest of society. And that drew people into Christianity despite the fact that they were heavily persecuted and slaughtered by the Roman government until the 3rd century, when Emperor Constantine made Christianity legal. Okay? That's what's going on right here. We're entering those times again, by the way. So as Christians are growing in our being persecuted, we need to unite together, both as a congregation and as a church body and as Christianity at large, and love one another as best we can. Yes, we're frail, human, sinful beings. But that speaks volumes to the world, that they may believe that you, God the Father, have sent me, God the Son. Okay? Points to that. Yeah, Ellen?
You wonder, why would anyone want to kill somebody because they did good? And, you know, because they might be happy to have that. Because they would even possibly be the recipient of some of that.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it made them touch their conscience.
Oh, they're killing Christians who are doing good things for other people?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would probably touch their conscience. Being an executioner in the Roman government and executing these Christians, and all they're doing is trying to help people who are sick. Why am I killing them? Yes, that I think that had a probably slow growing impact within the Roman culture at the time. Sure, Becky.
I think if you look around, you know, the world, and even since Christ was crucified and rose again, you begin to see that the Christians are responsible for caring for people in hospitals, nursing homes, in private homes.
Yeah.
Yes,
very powerful witness. And you don't even have to say anything. You're just caring for somebody who's poor or sick or handicapped or elderly. That's all. Just care for them. And you're doing a witness. Being a witness right there. Jesus prays for that. Okay? All right, moving on. Verses 22 and 23. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one, I and them, and you and me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me and loved me, even as you loved me. I didn't quite read that right, I think. That you sent me and loved them, even as you loved me. So, first of all, if you read these two verses, these two verses, Jesus is saying basically the same thing he just said, right? He's praying that we would be one, just as God the Father and God the Son are one, so that people will know that Jesus is God. Saying the same thing. Slightly different words. So why does Jesus say the same thing twice in a row? You notice that happens a lot in the Bible? In the Psalms, King David will say the same thing twice in a row, three times in a row. Isaiah and the prophets, they'll say the same thing three or four times in a row. Why is that?
To give emphasis.
Yeah, emphasis. Yeah.
I've heard that was characteristic of Hebrew writing.
Yeah, I think that's characteristic. That's kind of the style for Hebrew writing. Yeah, sure. And I think there's a practical reason, just to help us remember it. When you're trying to help your kids or grandkids memorize something, what do? You repeat it over and over, right? So I think Jesus is repeating himself here. However, it is slightly different. The meaning of these two verses is, while it's generally the same as the previous two verses, so Jesus is saying the same thing twice. Yeah, Bob?
I was told a long time ago that a good teacher is somebody who can teach to everybody, and everybody might need to hear it a little bit differently, but it's still the same thing.
Okay. So Jesus is saying the same thing here, but altering it slightly just so that it can sink into different people in a different manner. Yeah, that's a good point. So I think that's what's going on here. He's saying the same thing twice. Although one of the little changes here, in verse 22, he says, "The glory that you have given me, I have given to them." That is something that's slightly different from the previous two verses in content. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them. What is Jesus' glory?
His death on the cross.
Is Jesus' glory the fact that he's shiny on Transfiguration Day? That is a glory.
Yeah.
Is that the glory he's talking about here? No. He's speaking in the prophetic future that you have given me, I have given to them. So he's speaking after the fact, in the future, what glory has he given to them? Well, his ultimate glory, what he's known for, what his reputation is, even among non-Christians, is right there. Dying on the cross. A bloody, gory, painful, awful, horrible death. That's Jesus' glory. See, this is theology of the cross that Luther writes about. That's glory? Yes, because Jesus did that out of love for you. And that glory of his on the cross, he has given to you. He speaks that way. Even though he's speaking, this is on Maundy Thursday, he's speaking in the future. He has given that to you. Remember, he's praying about you. How has Jesus given the glory of the cross to you? How has he done that?
By sacrificing himself.
He sacrificed himself, yes. How has he delivered that to you?
Through
his word, through baptism, through the Lord's Supper, through faith in him. What is the glory that he earned on the cross? Forgiveness. What is your glory before God? Forgiveness. Jesus' glory is his suffering and death on the cross to earn forgiveness, and then he gives that forgiveness to you, which is your glory before God the Father. Because when you are forgiven, how do you appear to God the Father?
Perfect.
Holy. Perfect. Shiny. Right?
Like a shiny.
Like Transfiguration Day.
Or a shiny new penny.
Shiny. Now, shiny new penny, right. Radiant. There's the word. You appear radiant before God the Father because Jesus did that. Died on the cross in a horrible way. That's his glory, okay? So there is a slightly different nuance in verses 22 to 23 than there was in verses 20 and 21. So even though Jesus is repeating himself, there is a different nuance there. Yeah, Janet.
Didn't I say this like thinking as one, two, the creed every Sunday when we all say together.
Yes.
Exactly the same thing.
Yes.
And hopefully we're all thinking about what we are saying.
Yes. And I totally agree. And I love that about that. And when I kind of learned and it kind of sunk into my own brain that when we're saying the creeds, all three of them, mostly Apostles and Nicene, of course, we're saying the same words that Christians have said for 2,000 years or 1,900 years. Same thing. It not only is it a reminder of what we believe, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. Not only is it that, but it unites us. So that's why when I introduced the creed and started, I say, we say in unity. Even though we may have different political beliefs, different social beliefs, different opinions about sports teams that are going to win the college football championship, we have all those sorts of different opinions. We are united by saying the creed together. Right? We are. That's wonderful. So yes, good point, Janet. And yeah, that's actually specifically why I say that. We join together in unity, reciting our faith, publicly confessing our faith, by the way. Oh, if it ever came down to having some kind of terrorist group sweep through our nation and say, oh, if you're a Christian, we're going to kill you. You know, Muslim terrorists or something. You know, they could pick out all of you from our videos. You're making a public confession. If somebody were really that good at hacking into computers and looking at they could see, oh, look at all those people. They're on camera when they file up there for communion. Those Christians, we need to slaughter them because for whatever their terrorist beliefs would be, you know, whatever. So you're making a public confession. And we're being united together. We are being brought together in unity through the creed. Yes, it is wonderful. Absolutely. Okay, moving on. Verse 24. Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am, to see my glory that you have given me because you loved me before the foundation of the world. So here again, prophetic future. He wants us to be with him where he is. Well, where is he when he's speaking these words? In the upper room. So this is an example of the prophetic future. Because if you don't understand that, you're thinking, well, does he want us to all get into a transponder, or what's the Star Trek term where they get in the thing and then they zap?
Transporter.
Transporter?
Yeah.
Are we supposed to all get in a transporter and zap, we're back on into the upper room in Old Jerusalem? No. He's saying this prophetic future, after he ascends into heaven, what is his ultimate goal? That you would be with him in heaven, to share in his glory, to see my glory that you have given me because you loved me before the foundation of the world. Now, what was the glory Jesus had before creation? It was that radiance that he showed on Transfiguration Day. What will be his glory when we get there to heaven? It'll be both. He will be radiant in the glory of his divinity, while at the same time, what will he still have?
His
scars of crucifixion. So he's got the glory of divine as well as the glory of his sacrifice on the cross simultaneously. That will be the glory that we see in him when we get to heaven. Remember what Thomas said? Unless I see the marks of the nails, Jesus will bear those marks of crucifixion for the rest of eternity. And he did it for you. Out of love for you. See, this is incredible stuff, isn't it?
It is.
It's wonderful. All right. Continuing on, verse 25. O righteous Father, even though the world does not know you, I know you. And these know that you have sent me. These. Who's he referring to when he says these?
Us.
Well, right in front of him are the 11 apostles. But who is he praying for in this half of the high priestly prayer? Praying for you. Praying for you, that these may know what? That you sent me. It's key to know that Jesus was sent from God, that Jesus is divine and human. Oh, there's one of our five essential beliefs that you have to have, right? See, if you don't believe that correctly about Jesus, you don't really truly have faith. So that you may know that God the Father sent God the Son. He is divine. Yes, he is, absolutely. All right, you need to know that. You need to know that he's real, he's human, his miracles are real, his teaching is true, his death was authentic and actually happened, his resurrection is in the body, in the flesh, not some figurative spiritual thing, which some false religions would claim. Yes, you need to know that he was sent by God, that these know. He's speaking to you, okay? Verse 26, I made known to them your name, and I will continue to make it known, that the love with which you have loved me may be in them, and I in them. All right, what is God's name? I made known to them your name. What is God's name?
Yahweh.
In the Old Testament, it's Yahweh. What's the New Testament name that Jesus has revealed?
The Father.
Baptize them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. So we would say the Old Testament name of God that God gives to himself through the burning bush, yes, it's Yahweh, which means I am. The New Testament name which God gives to himself, which Jesus gives to us, he says, in the name of. So it's much more obvious and clearly Trinitarian in the New Testament. It is in the Old Testament as well. Yahweh is plural, actually. So it's more obvious. So he made known to them your name. Now, it's not in the Gospel of John that Jesus reveals the name Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's in the Gospel of Matthew that he does that. But John, writing this, knows Jesus is referring to that and reveals that New Testament name. And I will continue to make it known. How does Jesus continue to spread and make known the name of God, the true God? Through his
Word.
There it is again, okay? The Word is all important. that the love with which you have loved me may be in them and I in them. Absolutely again. So there's a lot of prayer for unity here, isn't there? Over and over again. Does Jesus want us to be unified?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Does Jesus want us to argue with one another?
No.
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 That's correct. Do we argue?
Yes.
Strongly debate.
Strongly debate? So that's one step better than less bad than argue? There you go. All right. All right, questions? Joanne.
Sometimes I wish my mind wouldn't think about stuff like this. But when you mention going to heaven, if God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit are one, aren't they going to be one in heaven? You won't see a God, Father, God, the Son, and the Holy Spirit individually, will you?
I don't know.
They're one.
Yeah, they are one, but they're three persons. How does that work? I don't know.
Well, that's what everyone wants to know.
Yeah, I think we will see them as individual people. I think we will see God the Father, we will see God the Son. You can talk to Jesus face to face, and God the Spirit will be a separate being. But yet they're one. Yeah, how does that work? I don't know. I don't know.
The mystery of his right hand.
Yeah, Jesus sits at the right hand of God the Father, which implies a separateness. But yet, we know they are one. The Lord your God is one. So, I don't have an answer. I don't think our brains on this side of heaven are even capable of understanding. So, you can ponder it all you want, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I can keep telling you, I don't know, and I don't know. When we get to heaven,
we'll know.
Then you'll know. Right.
I'll be like Mary and ponder these things in my heart.
There you go. That's right. Other questions or thoughts or comments?
Well,
Don.
Revelation, doesn't it sort of allude to the three different persons, you know?
Yeah.
The Father on the throne and then the Son holding the book.
Yeah.
So it was like at least two.
Yeah, and the Holy Spirit's in there in a few spots too. So yes, there are, I mean, the Trinity is taught throughout the Bible. Jesus reveals that, God reveals that to us in many places. How does that work? That's a stumbling block for many non-believers. How can you worship a God who's one God and three persons? That makes no sense. And I say, you're right, makes no sense. But that's how God reveals himself. That's what he tells us about himself. So you either believe it or you don't. Maybe is that a reason why our human brains are not allowed to understand it? Because that forces you to believe it, not to understand it. Maybe that's why God did that. I don't know. Okay, other questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah, Alan?
You'll be happy to know that when we get to heaven, there will be a booth that says, everything you ever wanted to know about God.
There you go.
Probably.
Yeah. And there won't be anybody at that booth. Because we don't care anymore. You're in heaven. All right. I'm going to do the first handful of verses in chapter 18 for this reason. We still got, on my watch, like 5 minutes or maybe a little bit more. You know, I always run a few minutes late, right?
Yeah.
And chapter 17 actually is a relatively short chapter, and chapter 18 is a relatively long chapter. So to try to balance it out time-wise in our classes, because I like to do a half a chapter per week, but 18 is a little bit too long to do half a chapter. So if I cover the first few verses here, that will help us in the next couple of weeks. So partly I want to hand... Who has the Lutheran Study Bible here?
Bob.
Okay, I am going to have Bob hand out this map. It is in the Lutheran Study Bible, so you don't need one if you have the Lutheran Study Bible. In the Lutheran Study Bible, it's page 1690. It's in Mark chapter 14. And so if you don't have that and you want a map, maybe I would say just one for couples. One per couple. How about that? And Bob, if you run out, you can run some more copies.
Okay.
All right. So chapter 18. So this is...
We have
the beginning, the end, it's the end, it's a transition. It's the end of Jesus' teaching and discussion with the disciples on Maundy Thursday, and now he's starting what's happening next. So it says in verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley, or the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. So when Jesus had spoken these words, John does a very good job of keeping a linear timeline, okay? So there is a linear timeline to show that right after he's done with his teaching, that he takes his disciples and he's going across the Kidron to a garden. Now the garden isn't named, but we know what garden that is, right?
Gethsemane.
Garden of Gethsemane. So, I see Bob has not quite passed out all the maps yet, but I'm going to start referencing it. Are you going to have enough? Does it look like? He hasn't passed out yet. Yeah, nice. Yeah. Got enough? Looks like it. Okay.
There's two left.
All right. So if you look on this, it's page 1690 in the Lutheran Study Bible. It's right by Mark chapter 14 in the Lutheran Study Bible. So you see, it's a little map of Jerusalem, old Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. And you see the Temple Mount kind of right in the middle. And then where it says number 7 over on the left-hand side, and then the line there, if you can see, it's maybe a little faded. It points kind of to the southwestern, the lower left portion of old Jerusalem. Somewhere in there, you want a map?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So somewhere in there is where Jesus met with his apostles and celebrated the Passover, which he turned into the Lord's Supper. And then you see the Kidron Valley. See it there along the eastern side of Jerusalem? It says Kidron Valley.
Yeah.
That was a low valley. It dropped way down. There's a little brook at the bottom of it. Often is dry during the dry season, but during the rest of the year, there's a little water in there. And then it goes back up. There's a rise. And you can see on the other page, it says Mount of Olives. And you can see all the lines there, the graphics. It shows it's a rise, like a hill. And you see where those distance markers are right next to the Temple Mount. It says meters and feet, and it gives you a little scale. Just to the right of those, that's where the Garden of Gethsemane was. It was on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. So Jesus would have taken his disciples through Old Jerusalem and then down into the Kidron Valley and then back up the other side part way, and he would have been in the Garden of Gethsemane. That's where he would have been, okay?
You don't have a map.
Well, I have the Lutheran Study Bible at home.
Well, there you go. Now you can be looking while I'm talking. Okay, so this says, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron, where there was a garden. So he's going to the same place. He goes there a lot. How many of you would have a favorite place to go, you know, maybe as a kid, if you go out and, go for a hike in the woods or ride your bike, you have a favorite place to go? I can tell you very briefly, growing up, the house that I grew up in, we had a ravine behind our house, much like so many houses here. And a couple of my playmates, the boys that I was with, we had some hiding spots down in there. You know, we would go down there and we dug a little shallow hole and we put sticks all around it and it was our fort. You know, how boys do that, right? Maybe
right.
Girls too. And so I think if my parents ever wanted to look for us and they couldn't see us, they would know to go look there. Good chance we were there. We were either playing army or defending the world from aliens or, you know, whatever. Jesus had a spot where he would go. Judas knew this spot. So it's in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he knew where it was. Now, there is still some remnants of the Garden of Gethsemane today. It's just awesome to be there. When you were there, Glenn, I'm just like, there is history here. This dates back to the time of Jesus. Just to be there. Yeah, you remember that too, Joan. However, the little remnant of the Garden of Gethsemane that is there today, it's relatively small. It's maybe the size of our gym. Back at the time of Jesus, it would have been much bigger and wider. You know, Olive trees do live an awful long time, 1,000 years or more. So somewhere in that garden, Judas knew where Jesus had the habit of going. So he and his disciples entered and they went to their spot. Okay? Now, the next part here. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. That's what I was just saying, that point. Judas knew the spot as well. Verse 3. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now here is where I'm going to disagree very publicly with the writers of the Lutheran Study Bible.
Really?
Yeah. This is what the footnote says in the Lutheran Study Bible right here. Chapter 18. Yeah, this is being recorded, but I don't mind saying this publicly. Chapter 18, verse 3 in the Lutheran Study Bible says this. Band, a cohort of Roman soldiers, a tenth of a legion. Not likely a whole cohort, which would normally be 500 to 600 soldiers, though numbers vary. Though concerned that rioting among the Galileans at the feast would be sparked by the arrest of Jesus, might have motivated the authorities to send a large detachment. Officers. Reinforcement of these police by Roman soldiers was necessary because the temple police failed to arrest Jesus previously and because the concern about resistance from the Galileans. So the Lutheran Study Bible claims that these soldiers, where are we, verse 3, band of soldiers and officers, the Lutheran Study Bible claims that those were mostly Roman soldiers. I don't think that was. For a couple of reasons, which I'm going to point out to you right here. One is, they're from the chief priests. See it right there? A band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests. That phrase modifies this right here grammatically. So I think these are not Roman soldiers. These are temple guard. The chief priests had their own temple guard. Why did they have a temple guard? These were Jewish soldiers that were armed. What did they do? Protected the temple from inappropriate entry. If you were a Gentile, how far could you go? You could go in the outermost court only, the court of Gentiles. And then there was temple guard there. Only Jews may go further. And then once you went in further, there was the court of women, and then there was the court of men, and then there was the court where the priests went, inside the temple. Only the priests could go there. So the temple guard were stationed all throughout there to maintain the proper access. All right? That was a big deal. Did the Roman soldiers go in there? Not unless provoked. Okay? So again, look at your map a little bit. See the Temple Mount? Then at the top left corner of the Temple Mount, you see like a little kind of angular structure there. That's the Praetorium. That's where the Romans built their barracks for their soldiers. It's right on the corner of the temple. Why? They didn't enter the temple unless there was rioting that they needed to quell. Because if they entered the temple unprompted, there would have been rioting. That itself would have started rioting. Okay? So they didn't go in. They stayed out of Jewish affairs unless there was violence. Okay? So again, that's another reason why I say that this band of soldiers from Judas are temple guard, not Roman soldiers. Who did Judas strike his deal with about betraying Jesus? The chief priests. Right? How much was he paid? 30 pieces of silver, the price of a slave. And so they gave him a detachment of temple guard, not Roman soldiers. I don't think the Romans were involved, personally. Just reading through the Gospels and commentaries, I don't think the Roman soldiers were involved until the chief priest turned Jesus over to Pilate. Then the Romans took control. Until then, they didn't care. Pilate didn't care initially. Oh, this is one of your matters, you know, it's one of your religious disputes. I don't care. Stay away from me. Well, he claimed to be Caesar. They said that. He didn't. They said that in order to get Pilate involved, right? So, for a couple of reasons, I think this is temple guard. And that's going to show up again in another verse here. I'm just going to do one or two more verses beyond this. And what are they doing? They're coming with lanterns and torches and weapons. And the word there, I looked it up, is weapons. It doesn't mean swords or clubs. It means all of the above. So military weapons, lanterns and torches. And another side note here that's that kind of comes into play in this fourth verse, then Jesus, knowing all that would happen, came forward. He came forward. He came to meet them. I remember Pastor Cordokas talking about this when he was at the Garden of Gethsemane in modern day, and I mentioned it to the group that was there with me, too, when we led them there. When you're on the Garden of Gethsemane, when you're in the Garden of Gethsemane, if you look at your map and you're kind of, say you're halfway up the hillside of the Mount of Olives, you're halfway up, you're looking across this valley. You can see the Temple Mount over there. It's actually a beautiful view. Judas and the soldiers would have emerged from that gate. See it right there on the eastern side of the temple?
Yes.
And then they would have had to go down into the valley and come back partway up the other side in order to find Jesus. That would have taken some time, 15, 20 minutes. It's nighttime. And what are they carrying?
Torches.
Lanterns and torches. Jesus would have seen them coming. Could he have snuck backwards up over the top of the Mount of Olives and disappeared into the night?
Yes.
Absolutely. He didn't. What did he do? He came forward. Mm-hmm. He came to meet them. He knew what was going to happen. He could have escaped it, but he didn't. He knew he needed to be arrested. He knew he needed to be tortured. He knew he needed to be crucified. That's incredible. Yeah. And I remember Pastor Q mentioning that to his group, and so I mentioned it to my group as well. And when you're standing there and you say, Jesus could have easily escaped. Well, think about this in the eyes of the apostles for a minute. Yes, they were sleepy. But all of a sudden, they see this group of torches emerging from the temple and coming toward them. Do you think they might have been nervous?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Jesus, we know they want to arrest you. Let's go sneak up, you know, elsewhere in the garden and hide. Or, you know, over the top and escape into the night. And Jesus says, no, we're waiting right here. In fact, I'm going forward towards them. I think the disciples might have been scared.
Yeah.
Significantly.
Right.
Okay. All right, so Jesus comes forward and said to them, whom do you seek? Proper grammar there, by the way. Whom do you seek? Not who do you seek? Yeah, that's the translators, because that's not actually what Jesus said in Greek. But the English translation there is proper grammar.
What did he say in Greek?
You know, I didn't look it up. I'd have to look it up. By the way, what is not said here in this account? What is not? What detail is not portrayed to us? Jesus praying?
Oh, yes.
We know he prayed in the garden, right?
Right.
For a while.
Yeah.
He prayed for quite a while. That's not here in the Gospel of John. That's recorded in the other Gospels for us. So John kind of gets down right down to business. He skips over Jesus praying. Doesn't mean he didn't pray. It just means John didn't record it for us. So he says, right. Whom do you seek? And now this band of temple soldiers led by Judas, they answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. And here's another reason why I think this is temple guard. Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am he. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. What? You know why? I bet some of you can guess why. Jesus didn't actually say, I am he. This is yet another case in the Gospel of John. Then I looked this one up. In the Greek, it says, ego I me. That's the Greek translation of the name Yahweh. Jesus basically says, in Greek, he says, Yahweh, I am. A better translation here would have been capital I space capital A capital M period. That would have been a better translation here. Yes. And I know the King James makes this mistake, the NIV makes this mistake, the RSV makes this mistake, and they say, I am he. No, that's not what Jesus said. It's significant. Jesus said, I am. And if these were Roman soldiers, what would they have said? I don't care who you think you are. You're under arrest. Yeah. But these are temple guard. So what do? They kind of are drawn back. They're like, whoa, this is more serious than we thought. Who is this guy? He's claiming to be the Messiah. He says, Yahweh, I am, ego I me. So they draw back and fell to the ground because they're kind of stunned. What is going on here? Again, another piece of proof, I think, that these are temple guard, not Roman soldiers. However, the bigger point here is, this is yet another time, right at his arrest, where Jesus is claiming to be God. I am. And they draw back and fell to the ground. Okay? So Jesus asked them again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And this is where I stopped last night. I'm going to stop here tonight. So yes, I'm whatever, 12 minutes over or something. This is a good spot to stop. We've knocked off a little bit of this chapter, so the next time we meet, 2 weeks from now, remember, we'll pick up right around here, around verses 6 or 7 in chapter 18, and do half of the chapter, so we've got a little better time. Any questions about this right here? This is very profound, actually, that Jesus says, I am, and they draw back and fall down because they're stunned. They don't know what to make of that.
I just wondered, in pictures and so forth that they depict this, you see maybe 12 or 15 soldiers or whatever. Now, do you still think there were hundreds?
No. I think there was probably a dozen or at most two dozen temple guard. I don't think it was a cohort of Roman soldiers. Yes, a cohort, which is an actual term in the Roman military, and it meant a tenth of a legion, which would be in the order of hundreds. No, I don't think there were hundreds of Roman soldiers standing here in the Garden of Gethsemane trying to arrest Jesus. So that's why I very much publicly disagree with that footnote in the Lutheran Study Bible. Okay? Yes, I think this was a couple dozen temple guard. And here's another reason why. Because they understood what Jesus was saying when he said, I am. And that is a very profound statement. It is a very provocative statement. It's why the Jewish leaders wanted to arrest him, because he claimed to be God. And they said, "That's you're not God, but you're claiming to be God, so that's blasphemy." Well, it's not blasphemy because he really is God. Mm-hmm. You don't believe it. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. Okay? Linda.
Well, and I think why Jesus stepped forward is he was protecting his people. Because nobody, he said no one would be hurt. So he stepped forward and said...
That may be. He was giving himself up. And because we will get to it at the start of the next class, he says, let these men go. So yes, he's saying, arrest me. I'm the one you want. I'm the one who has to go through this. Let the rest of these men go. So yeah, that is a little part of it. I agree. Yeah.
And another study that I had, the Kidron Brook was the channel from the altar that drained the blood from the sacrifices, and it was reddish in color. Hmm. And so when Jesus got to that point, it probably reminded him of what he was going to have to go through as the sacrifice.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Any blood from the sacrifices would have found its way down to the Kidron Valley. That's true. I've never heard that before, but that is true. If you look at your little map, that's the natural drainage direction. So, yeah, I suppose if Jesus saw some remnants of sacrificial blood as he's crossing the Kidron Valley, that could have been, a reminder, significant there. Yeah, sure.
Very interesting.
Yeah. All right. Other questions or comments? All right, very good. Remember, come back in 2 weeks.
The 29th.
I don't remember if I told Christy to correct the calendar in the bulletin. So if it shows up in the bulletin
as a
Bible study next Wednesday, ignore it. No Bible study next Wednesday, okay? All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Boy.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory,
coming. Have a good day.